Hi, this is Manton Reese.
And this is Daniel Jalkut.
And this is Core Intuition. Actually, I am a little worried. This episode is sponsored by Tuparev Technologies and Linode.
Manton, I did something strange this year. I watched a keynote for a conference that is not WWDC.
Mm-hmm.
I guess maybe, given where, you know, given my Apple allegiance and given that I'm a little skeptical of Google in a lot of ways, maybe it's a triumph for Google. not to elevate my own importance too much, but maybe it's a triumph for Google that they finally got me to watch their Google I/O keynote.
So think about this. Last week we talked about that I had an Android phone.
Yeah.
This week you're watching their keynote.
I don't know what's happening.
What's the world
coming to us. In all seriousness, I don't think it's a major deal that I individually watched it, but I kind of feel like more of my colleagues and friends are paying attention to Google than ever before. And to be honest, the content of the keynote was compelling. A lot of it was. And, you know, the reasonable pushback against the keynote is that, oh, this is just Google. They're famous for announcing stuff like Google Glass that's not really ever going to be ready for prime time. And then, you know, they announce it at I/O and then they spend years not really shipping it. I don't know enough about Google, I guess, to say whether that seems likely for some of the stuff they announced a couple days ago. But to be honest, it seems like they probably... seems kind of like they've turned a leaf or something. And I don't know if it's the reorganization that like makes Google its own kind of independent, smaller piece of Alphabet. But I was fairly impressed.
I agree. And I liked it. I watched the keynote. Mm-hmm. Although I could criticize it in the same kind of theme that you just had about kind of vaporware or products that don't really matter to consumers. The stuff that I was most interested in is not ready.
Yeah.
So like the Google Home device is not ready to ship. The chat app, video conferencing app, those kind of apps that will be available for Android and iOS, not ready. So, I mean, I'm not going to criticize them too much. I'm just saying some of the key pieces of the keynote are not ready yet.
Yeah. And it's one of those things where, to be honest, while I was watching the keynote, seeing some of the things that they have access to and, you know, all that data, mm-hmm. all that creepy, creepy data, right? All that, like, show me a picture of me, you know, smiling at Disneyland. And it's like, oh, sure, we know when you were at Disneyland and we know what your smile looks like. And you know, oh, yeah. You must have been having a bad day that day. you know, all that data is creepy to me, but it's undeniable that it affords Google some features, you know, or the potential for some features that Apple doesn't have a chance at providing.
Right.
So watching the keynote, I'm like, I don't really want any company to know all this stuff about me. But then there's like, yeah, but I kind of do want to be able to just say, Google, given everything that you know about me, what restaurant should I go to? And it'll be like, well, you know, you had that embarrassing stomach flu or whatever. and then like the demo of the chat app. And
well, that's the funny thing is it's like, I want them to know enough to give me helpful things and make my life easier. But some of the chat, I don't want the chat app to talk for me.
Exactly.
I think I can pick my own words. I don't know.
It kind of seemed like a little bit like, oh, like who's this third wheel in the chat, right?
Right. But there's definitely something to that data. I wrote a blog post last night. I published it this morning. Basically making the point that as much as I love like the Amazon Echo, and I've talked about it a lot on the show, and as much as I'm excited about the potential for Siri, like it seems like in the long run, Google is just going to be unstoppable, because for doing these intelligent assistant type devices and apps, they just have more data and more AI and just more everything than anybody else.
Well, it's kind of a it's kind of connected to the fact that if you're anything like me, you still use Google search, even though you have possibly misgivings about, you know, the company and privacy considerations.
Well, and I'll say here that I tried not to use Google search for a long time. I used DuckDuckGo for maybe a year or more. And before that, I used Bing for a while because I wanted to try other things. And I think, how much different could it be? But I ended up going back to Google search because it actually is significantly better, especially for the types of searches that we as programmers tend to do. Google is just quite a bit better for those kind of searches.
So I think everybody more or less agrees that Google has had one product that pretty much everybody agrees is a success, and that's search. You know, there's a lot of other products that are huge successes, but not everybody really agrees. Like, I don't use Gmail, for example. Like, I don't know. I think most people would agree that, like, not only from a financial point of view, like, Google made all of its money off of search, but also it's the product with the hugest impact on the world. And then it makes me sort of wonder, though, like, are they the kind of company that can like, keep making things that are as successful as the search? Something that kind of like drove this home for me was they have the new chat app called Allo, and they have a video conferencing app. So Allo is kind of their iMessage, right? And Duo is their FaceTime. These are two new announced apps, video conferencing and direct messaging. Somebody made a quip on Twitter to see if I can dig it up. They're like, so this adds to Google's list of Google Hangouts, Google Talk, Google Voice, Google Plus for that matter, and just like went down the line of like all of these essentially chat products that Google has made.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, and it's funny because I was the Sundar reality distortion field was having me think, as you know, Allo is being produced. I'm like, oh my gosh, wow, I never thought about that. Google doesn't have a chat. Like, Google doesn't have chat. Google doesn't have an iMessage.
Right. They've only tried 3 or 4 times.
Right. And I'm thinking, oh, yeah. After I saw that, I was like, so that sort of begs the question, like, what makes this new set of tries any more likely to succeed? And, you know, both of us, you and I, Manton, had this like reaction, like, oh, they're just so good at this stuff, like at like data. And there's this chasm, I think, between where we imagine Google applying that data and that knowledge in a really meaningful, useful way, and the way that they have so far applied that data. Like, I think most people also who have tried Google Photos agree that that's a really impressive product. But, you know, they've had all this data for a long, long time, and it hasn't made, like, using Google Hangouts the most fun thing in the world.
So I think here's my take on the Allo, and I don't know if I'm right about this because I haven't actually looked into any detailed reviews of this other than the just kind of, you know, screenshot or video of like, hey, you can make your text bigger, which, by the way, I do not like that feature at all. I do not want someone shouting at me. All caps is bad enough. But my take on that is that it's different it's more iMessage-like in who you'll be able to contact, I think, because if you think about how they introduced it, they said it's tied to a phone number, not your Google account only.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the reason iMessage was successful is they didn't make a new app. It was the SMS app that you could then iMessage automatically if someone had an iPhone. I have a feeling that Allo is going to be exactly like that. You'll be able to use that one app to SMS people that have old Android phones, that have iPhones, that have whatever. And if those people have a modern Android phone and have Allo, then you'll get the fancy features. I have a feeling that that's what they're doing. Mm-hmm. If they're not, they should do that. But I think it will succeed in a way that Hangouts and everything else they've tried won't, just because of that phone number aspect.
Yeah, and actually, to their credit, I had the strong impression, based on their announcement, that they would have an iOS app that you'll be able to use Allo perhaps with most, if not all, of the features from an iPhone.
Yeah, that's I got that impression. And
that's distinct from Apple's attitude with iMessage.
Oh, yeah, that's very true. Well, and that's a great point. And that's, like, if Allo takes off, you could imagine, maybe it will never be as big as iMessage because it's not built into iOS in the same way that Ben Thompson made this point in his essay this morning. As great as Google Maps is, everyone uses Apple Maps because it's built in.
Yeah.
And so maybe there'll be, but maybe there'll be still some of that, but you can imagine Allo being pretty compelling if it's something that most people can use. It's frustrating when I have to text Android friends. It's like, you got to go back to whatever, 10 years ago when it's just SMS only.
Well, here's one thing, by using phone numbers exclusively, which is what it sounds like they're doing, they get an in to anybody's iMessages. I mean, into their into the Messages app. Because, you know, Google's a big company. They have lots of telecom stuff. They have already got Google Voice and their own junk going on. It's no big deal for them to send a regular SMS text message to you. So I imagine what will happen is if you send a message from Allo to a non-Allo user, you'll get this nice little SMS message that says, "Hey, what's up?" And then it'll say, like, another message will, like, come that said, like, from Google, from, like, Google that says, "You received an Allo message. Wouldn't it be great to see whispering and screaming and animated aardvarks and all the other great stuff?" And you'll be like, "Yikes." But, you know, it is a way for them to nose their way into any platform's Messages app if that platform's app also supports SMS.
Yeah, seems smart. I mean, I can't really argue with their approach here.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, too, is just, yeah, I find myself being just less skeptical of the things that Google's doing. I mean, I hate the fact that basically their whole business is based on ads, because I hate ads and I hate imagining a future where everything is ads, ads, ads only. But they are kind of uniquely positioned to do some of these kind of big things, especially around voice. I just don't see how other folks can catch up. I made a point in this blog post that the only hope really is we need an open voice standard of some kind that potentially multiple people can support and that it's extensible. I mean, Siri is famously not extensible at all, at least Alexa has some basic, you know, skills you can add via, you know, third-party developers. You can write your own, you know, basic stuff. I would love to see Apple open up Siri quite a bit and think about even bigger than just a simple API where you can, like, I don't know, add a quote-unquote app that knows how to answer a question, but like something bigger. Because if you think about the future of, if everything is really going this way, where voice is going to be such a huge part of how we interact with computers, I don't want one person and one platform to control all of that. I want it to be like the web was.
Yeah.
You know, where it's like, no, this is an open thing that's going to last for decades. I'd love for voice to be like that.
And particularly from Apple's point of view, if they accept that there are certain kind of like things that they just can't do with voice because they don't have the data or whatever, then it's kind of analogous to the value that Apple gets by supporting third-party apps on the phone. And, like, I don't think anybody over the past several years would argue that Apple hasn't benefited from Google Maps remaining an installable app on iOS. And in that same, by that same way of thinking, it would make sense if, you know, Apple could say, you know what, Google's really good at this voice stuff. Maybe the Siri API should provide a direct conduit to Google. Mm-hmm. And I think it should, you know,
to anybody though, like anybody should be able to, I mean, think about like just app discoverability through this. Like when the App Store launched, all of a sudden, a lot of developers got to have their app in front of people that they were it's going to be hard to like spread the word about their app before. Like it was really great for developers in a lot of ways. on mobile. We can complain about different app store things, but like it allowed you to have your app in front of people. And like, if I think about voice, I think about what if it could be the same way where like, I should be able to ask whatever voice assistant, I should be able to say like, start a blog post or something. And, yep. And then it could say, I don't know how to do that. Do you want to add the Mars Edit plugin? And I'll say yes. And then I dictate, you know, I mean, like, mm-hmm. like exposing apps at that level where I can just ask these like really hard questions and Siri or Google Voice or Alexa or whatever can just say, okay, I have something that might do that for you. I'm going to enable it and yeah. we'll go from there. I don't know. I find that like idea really powerful and great for developers if you could do something like that.
Yeah, well, that's like a natural extension of the way that search already works on iOS. You know, you type in, hopefully, if you type in, WordPress, let's say, into the search in iOS, it says, well, I don't know what the heck WordPress is, but here are some results from the App Store. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of a similar idea. Like,
yeah, the key difference, I think, with the voice is like, It's both potentially a way to kind of search for things that you can do and also the interface for doing them. There's something there. I don't know exactly what it looks like and I don't know how to build the API, but I feel like there's something that could be really great for developers if these voice assistant platforms were open and not just locked down to one thing.
Yeah. Well, I think like a sort of tentative first step that shouldn't be too much of a risk for Apple would just be to support a kind of like with or using clause, mm-hmm. right? So if I say start a new blog post with Mars Edit, that should do it for me. Or I should be able to say directions home with Google Maps, to be honest, right? It's mm-hmm. it's annoying. I have to open, you know, if I want to use a non-Apple solution, I have to like go navigate to that app and da 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 da. But yeah, it's one of the areas where Apple is not exhibiting its confidence the way that they often have. They've often been like, here's a whole bunch of choices. We're going to give them all to you because we think you're going to pick ours because ours is the best. And you know, they do that in some ways. They do support like the fact that you can search for apps that way is at least something. It's a concession in that respect. But I feel like Apple's at its best when they let their own versions of solutions be an option to its customers instead of just being like the only way that you can do mm-hmm. something efficiently, you know. And that's the way that right now this Siri behavior is Maps. It's all tied to just their solutions, and it's not right.
Yeah, and so like the Alexa Skills API, just to follow up on this, it's kind of like what you describe, where you say, you know, like ask Mars Edit to do something. It's a little structured, a little more structured than I think long term we'd want it to be. But it is there. It is something that Siri doesn't have.
Right.
Now you're right. I mean, we talk about Apple being stretched too thin a lot. And they can't do everything. They can't have the best app in every category.
Right.
So they should lean on developers to help as much as possible.
And maybe importantly, lean on developers while they have the weight to lean. Because when I think about like this long-term advantage that Google has, for example, I think, well, if that starts to chip away at Apple's power, Apple's position becomes less and less. Like right now, I think it's an interesting time because Google does not hesitate to put its own services on iOS. And they even mentioned iOS several times during their keynote. Yep. You know, they said this is going to be available for Android and iOS. And that's a position of privilege that if one of these competitors, you know, Google, namely, is going to chip away at Apple's position further, well, they're going to lose that. Like, so like, in other words, like get them to make the apps for your platform now before, cause I don't know. I'm probably being a little paranoid, but I did the IO keynote was effective enough for me that it opened my thinking to, well, what am I going to do when the day comes that an Android phone can do like an order of magnitude more things for me than an iOS phone?
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't anticipate liking the user interface better. The aesthetics of that Allo stuff, like you said, the screaming and the whispering and like the kind of cheesy stickers and that stuff doesn't, I mean, I know it's popular.
Get used to the stickers because they're everywhere.
No, I know they are, but in particular, the art I saw in that keynote didn't look like my style. Let's just put it
I know what you mean though. Like, what do you do when?
Yeah.
Luckily, I feel like, I mean, it's easy to compare this to, you know, 1990s Windows versus Mac. You know, Windows in some ways was more powerful and it was more widespread, but we could always at least cling to the idea that the Mac was just better, easier to use, had more thoughtful design. You can imagine, though, like Android. Like I said, I didn't like this phone that I've been playing with, but like you can imagine the future, like it's not that bad. Like they've made huge, huge progress on design. And if it is significantly more powerful, I mean, we all have to take a fair look at things and not get an iPhone just because it's an iPhone. I think that's a ways off still. I think the iPhone is going to be much more pleasant for me to use. And I think I would just prefer it for years to come, but you never know.
And I still think Apple might surprise folks with the ways that they improve even these types of products where they're perceived as having, you know, a disadvantage, like Siri. Because I think Apple has shown over the last several years that they're incredibly invested in Siri. And the areas where they won't succeed, or they areas where they won't best Google, are those areas of like widespread, you know, collated personal information from everybody in the world, that kind of stuff. Apple doesn't have that stuff, right? But the usability areas are where they could succeed. And I think that's maybe what is so like kind of annoying right now, is that Siri has a few little tricks, but it seems more often than not to be like not a highlight of usability, right? It doesn't seem to like highlight Apple's attention to detail as well as it could. But that's an area where they could end up being better than Google at making voice interfaces more usable, even if they don't have all the same data that Google does.
I think that's a great point. Yeah, make it more user-friendly and fun to interact with, because it's frustrating when you ask any of these things a question and it has no idea what you're talking about. Make it more pleasant, and that will go a long way to covering up the fact that they don't have access to all the world's information.
Right.
Also, the rumor is that the next version of Mac will have Siri, but that's fine and that's good. But I think that Apple should also get away from the idea that Siri is a once a year new feature release. Like, I'm sure they're improving it all the time, but I think they should significantly improve it all the time. This is an opportunity for them to take a major important part, the functionality of iOS and coming up macOS 10, and decouple it from releases. They should be rolling out improvements all the time on the server without requiring any kind of iOS update.
I agree. I think, I think between Siri and Maps, they got their work cut out for them, but there's a lot of work that they could be doing incrementally in between releases. So,
and letting people know too, like Alexa, Amazon is really good about sending emails once a week, maybe, or once every couple weeks with like, I think it might even be once a week. Like, here's what's new in Alexa. Like here, like literally in the last 2 weeks, we added these five features that you can do. Like they are really good about highlighting that stuff. Apple should do that same kind of thing. Maybe they need a Siri blog or something. I don't know. Because I don't know, you got to educate people on what they can even do with this technology.
Okay, folks, we're happy to have back sponsoring the show our friends at Tuparev Technologies. Do you have a complex software problem but can't find the right people to solve it? You need a team that can dive into specific domains, integrate with existing software systems, and yet has the expertise to develop long-lasting, evolving professional solutions. All of this is even harder to find in a company with reasonable fees. But fear not, Tuparev Technologies is just such a company. They specialize in developing and hosting complex client-server solutions. They can build and integrate everything from web apps to custom client apps for any Apple device to server backends. Or they can do it all for you. For 15 years, they have completed projects as diverse as a complete software solution for remotely controlled robotic astronomical observatories. Boy, that's a mouthful, but they can take care of it. Document exchange software for major European banks, communal waste management and logistics systems, and other billing and logistics systems for a wide range of industries. The team is spread across Europe, including experts for every phase of a product. Renowned designers, developers, QA folks, and hosting specialists. They speak many different human and computer languages and come from a variety of academic backgrounds. So thanks very much to Tuparev Technologies for sponsoring the show.
All right, it's great to have them back sponsoring the show. We were talking earlier about Siri and just server data, and I always feel like developers need to be better about thinking about apps that are not just like a standalone little iPhone app. Like, users expect server data. They expect login things and cloud data and syncing. And so I love that he's highlighting in this a bunch of their experience with making web backends and handling both the client and the server stuff for you. They're longtime Apple developers too. In the Core Intuition chat, they chime in a lot about like experience from NextStep, and so a lot of developers with a lot of experience. And you should definitely check them out if you need to build something like this. It doesn't have to be astronomical equipment or whatever. It can be simpler, but they have some great experience you can draw on. And again, highlighting the client apps, server apps, kind of the whole package.
Yeah, Mantine, you look at what this company has done, and it's just like, okay, they can handle whatever I need, because if they're handling robots and astronomy and banks and education systems and waste management and all this other junk, literally, you know, that they can probably handle whatever you need done for your iOS or Mac app and into your server backend. So thanks again to Tuparev Technologies for sponsoring the show. And you can learn more at tuparev.com/coreint. That's Tuparev, TUPAREV.com. Thanks so much for sponsoring the show. Well, Manton, pigs are flying in Cupertino because Apple's WWDC 2016 official page has a section for people attending. This is great. They actually acknowledge the fact that people who are going to be in San Francisco who are not actually attending WWDC. It says, oh man, I missed it. I thought I had seen something before that said whether or not you're attending this conference, but maybe they edited that, or maybe I imagined it. It says, in addition to WWDC, a variety of other exciting developer events will take place throughout the week in San Francisco. And boy, this is just like, are you kidding me? Because we've been doing this show for many years now, Manton. We've probably been doing this show since before WWDC even sold out. Mm-hmm. And I mean that like before it would typically sell all of its tickets every year. We've seen, like, for example, CocoConf trying to do a conference the same week and having some pushback from Apple about doing that. We've seen Apple putting putting their foot down about AltConf streaming the keynote. The last thing, frankly, I expected from Apple, although things I expect from Apple are changing very rapidly, and so this is an example of that. But the last thing I expected was a section on the official WWDC page, developer.apple.com/WWDC/attending. Around San Francisco, they give links to four events: AltConf 2016, which of course is a free community conference that's been going on for several years now. Layers, which is in its second year now, a design-oriented conference. And then they have a couple kind of party events. The Loop from Jim Dalrymple's Beard Bash, which I think is co-sponsored this year with iMore. Also the talk show with John Gruber, which is a live recording of the talk show that's been going on for several years. Last year, they had Phil Schiller, which was kind of a big surprise. And what was the year before? There was also a big surprise. they keep They keep upping the ante.
This is great. Yeah, so which are you more surprised by? That they listed community events on the WWDC page or that apps take one day to review? Because every week we're getting some great news from Apple.
It's true. I don't know. And can we credit the fact that WWDC's official page now points people to third-party conferences and sort of implicitly blesses them as good things to do during the week? Can we credit that with Phil Schiller having some new position? I don't know.
We got to credit somebody.
We got to credit somebody.
So I was just thinking, like, I wonder if this is the... do you think this is the first time that Apple's ever linked to Daring Fireball?
I was just
thinking about it. You know, it's like, because we're used to reading blogs all the day, you know, every day, and links are always going back and forth, but Apple very rarely links to anyone.
That's a good question. A link versus just a statement is a distinction, because remember there was that great, I think Steve Jobs statement about Daring Fireball where he said it's like not too negative or something.
Oh, I forgot about that.
John Gruber's post, here it is. Here it is. Steve Jobs' response. It was an email. That's what it was. It was an email response that Steve Jobs had replied to somebody who sent an email. And Steve Jobs says just succinctly, "We think John Gruber's post is very insightful and not negative," and then links to. But that was a link in an email. That
right,
was different.
That doesn't count. It counts.
Sure, it was John Gruber's like best day of his professional life, but it wasn't a link from a .apple.com high-level page.
No, this is great. Yeah. I mean, there's only four things on this page, and if you're going to highlight four, I mean, they picked four great ones, I think. But the fact that they're doing this at all is pretty great. You know, we complain about Apple a lot, but like when they do something great like this, or like the app review thing I just joked about, I mean, yes, this is good.
And did I tell you, I know I tweeted about it, but did I tell you I was also the benefactor of that rapid app review? Like with FlexTime, I did a FlexTime update. I was approved in just over 4 hours from submission to review to approval.
That's great.
You have to reorganize your whole way of thinking about about the App Store, because I was in the mood of like, okay, well, I release stuff and then I publish it up on the App Store and then I wait a week or so, and then occasionally I would forget. I'd be like, oh wait, am I forgetting something? Oh yeah, there's that App Store submission I put up there. But now it's like it will change the way that I treat the App Store. That's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. I mean, it used to be when Test Flight was like not working very well, sometimes my like betas that were automatically approved and not even reviewed by a human would take 3 to 4 hours. They would just kind of get stuck processing for a little while. So the fact that a human actually reviewed and approved the app within 4 hours is pretty great.
Yeah,
I'm excited. I love that they're rolling out a couple things that, I don't know, make the developer community better and happier leading up to WWDC, because I think it'll just improve the mindset of everyone, you know, getting, if there was a whole bunch of negative Apple news over the last, you know, week or two, it's like, then you go into the keynote and you're like, you know, you're kind of grumpy about it. And
right.
So now I think people will be feeling pretty great.
Well, we'll be feeling great, but then the question is this like a teaser for all the great stuff we're going to get at WWDC, or I think you're going to go to WWDC, go to the keynote and say like, look at all the great stuff we did this spring. Our work here is done.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, I really hope that they acknowledge the app reviews. And I have a feeling they won't. But if they acknowledge it and say, you know, you might have noticed, like, we're really improving the app review time. We're trying to get it down to 1 or 2 days.
Yeah.
Or don't even mention number of days. Just acknowledge the fact that it's faster. I think developers who are still kind of skeptical will be able to breathe a sigh of relief as well to say, oh, this is a real thing. I mean, obviously they made a conscious choice to make it faster. I've always thought that they could make it faster if they wanted to, and now they want to, and they've done it. But actually saying that to a large developer audience would be really great.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely prefer the actions over over the talk, but I would like to hear some more talk, especially if it's talking about things that, you know, maybe bigger scale things that they could do. So, you know, when the big news that there was a kind of like a shakeup at Apple and Phil Schiller took over like the parts of the App Store that were like previously in Eddie Q's hands. And this optimism is not per se like a condemnation of Eddie Q, just to say, like, I think the App Store may have been suffering by being split up among two departments, independent of who the individuals are who are in charge of those departments, right? Like, it just didn't, if you think like, how could an App Store be so screwed up in some ways? One plausible explanation is that there's no single organization in charge of making it great. And so I'm optimistic that, you know, if things are as it's been reported and that like the App Store is kind of more under one division or department's control, I'd hate to get too optimistic, but we could be in for some surprises this WWDC. And I don't know what the kinds of things that they could surprise us with are, but there's a long list of things we've been complaining about.
Well, do you have any expectations leading up to this conference? You know, we talk every year kind of about like what we hope is going to happen, and it feels like a lot of years we're just like, well, you know, we'll see what we get. we don't really know. But do you have anything specific this year that you'd love to see?
Oh boy, you know, I am hesitant to be optimistic because I'll just be disappointed. But I'll tell you what, I feel like more than ever before, I expect Apple to give developers things that developers have been asking for with a slightly higher probability than giving things developers things that they didn't expect in the slightest, right? It's like, for many years now, it's been like, oh, we want trials. We want upgrade pricing. We want better App Store search. And then Apple's like, how about sandboxing?
Right. Will this help?
Yeah. We heard you, and here's sandboxing. Right. Or, you know, we heard you, and here's, I don't know, I'm sure that from people unlike me, they were hearing, we want in-app purchases. But, you know, that's not the kind of stuff that really floats my boat. So,
well, Apple might have heard we want trials and upgrades and said,
yeah,
is there a feature that we can do that would solve kind of part of both of those? Here's in-app purchases.
Yeah, I think there's some truth to that. And I think it's extremely shallow thinking that puts that back on the shelf after delivering in-app purchases. But we'll hand it to them that it solves some of the problems, but not nearly all of them.
Well, I'm not expecting a big App Store shakeup this WWDC. I will be shocked if there's any major change, yeah, like upgrades and trials and things like that, that would really kind of take the App Store and jumble it around a little bit in terms of business models and everything.
Yeah, and I think it's not very newsworthy. You know, like to some extent, the kind of stuff where they're actually just catching up to other platforms is stuff that they probably shouldn't do at the developer conference. So, for example, it's good that they're doing this, like, oh, we review your app within a day, like de facto change without making an announcement about it. Because if they make an announcement about it, all the news articles will say, this is something that Google has done since day one.
Good point. Yeah.
And so they don't want to have like their big developer conference news be stuff that's like easily editorialized as finally catching up to something that Google has done forever.
Yeah.
And like in that sense, it's like, well, they want to make announcements that differentiate themselves from Google, Microsoft, whatever other platforms they, you know, see as competitors. And making announcements that are just like, we finally do what they do. Maybe they're better off soft releasing that stuff.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, interestingly, a few of the parts of the keynote at Google I/O felt like catch up to Apple. Duo with FaceTime, kind of similar, mm-hmm, iMessage that we talked about, but also Android features like split screen. I didn't realize that Android didn't have split screen yet. And okay, it looks like they took it one step further than we have on iOS, since we only have it on the iPad. And on Android, you can do a split screen on a phone, which is pretty cool. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would like that on my phone, even my small 4-inch iPhone. I wouldn't mind doing split screen every once in a while.
Yeah, also, I noticed like Google TV, whatever that is, looks like Apple TV. I mean, it's like, that's an example where I think the UI gets less and less distinguished as you get into these kind of set-top box type
interfaces. There's only so many ways a TV interface can look.
Yeah, and I was like, wow, that looks kind of nice. I'll take that. But I'm sure if I used it, I'd find something to complain about.
So we don't know what to expect at WWDC. We're just along for the ride. Well, hopefully there'll be some good stuff. Hopefully they don't go too crazy with iOS 10 and macOS 11. I don't know what the 10.12, 13, who knows what they're going to call these things. But hopefully it's some, I don't know. I feel like just turn out some good features.
Yeah.
Have some more developer APIs. Maybe have some kind of story around Swift and what the future is going to look like in terms of frameworks, maybe. And go from there.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to it. All right, back this week, sponsoring the show, our friends at Linode. Of course, Linode knows that lots of people listening to our show might need a Linux box. They might need it to host a website, a private Git repository, or maybe serve as the back end for your latest iOS app. So if you're in that group, you should consider Linode Cloud Hosting. They've been doing infrastructure as a service since 2003. They give their customers free upgrades, and they have 8 global data centers equipped with industry-leading data center-grade SSDs. Now, when you host with Linode, you get full root access. So you get full control of your VMs, your containers, everything. You also get clear, precise hourly billing with a monthly pricing cap, add-ons for load balancing system metrics, and backups. Perhaps best of all, there's 24/7, 365 days a year customer support. It's a great full-service cloud hosting service, and it's very reasonably priced. Great news for Core Intuition listeners. On top of the already reasonable pricing, if you use the code CoreIntuition20, you'll get a $20 discount. And that's equivalent to 2 free months at their starting rate of just $10 a month. So you can learn a lot more about Linode, all the great things that they have to offer you at linode.com/coreint. Thanks so much to Linode for sponsoring the show.
Yeah, I'm a happy Linode customer. I've been using them for a long time, and I have a bunch of Linode instances for things like web apps, backends for my iOS apps, database servers. If you have anything like that, Linode's a great choice. Or if you just have maybe a blog or something that you want to be fast and reliable and you want it on a host that you can control, Linode is great for that. And the thing is, they don't mess with your stuff. Like you deploy an instance of a Linux server, you do what you need to, and it just runs. Like I have some old static sites on a different host that I won't name. And just like a couple of months ago, they decided to move my account to a different server, and basically everything broke because I have my DNS for everything managed externally, and so they didn't know to update that, and so my site's broke for a few hours or whatever until I could fix it. And you just don't have those problems with Linode. Things just run. I have one of my database servers is Redis, which is an in-memory database, and that kind of matters because if the server goes down or gets restarted, you have to think about, well, you got to save the data. It saves, in my case, it's saving more often, but like you have basically, gigabytes of, data and memory. And if something happens, it's kind of a big deal. And every once in a while I'll poke in, I'll notice just like these servers have just been running for a very, very long time. So can't say enough great things about Linode. Hope you check it out and use the coupon code CoreIntuition20 to save $20. You can learn more at linode.com/coreint. All right, Daniel. Well, we should check in on Swift progress. I think this will be a recurring topic over time for us. You have dived in a little bit. I'm working a lot on an app now that is basically all Swift. It's been interesting. So what's latest in your world with Swift?
Well, we've been following Swift now since it was launched almost 2 years ago at WWDC 2014. And then, of course, the big news in late last year was they finally went open source with it. And now this big evolution process has been happening on Swift Evolution. I signed up for that list, and then I was like, whoa, this is like not my life. Like I cannot give like my whole life to following everything that's going on in Swift. And thankfully, other people who either do that or come close to it are blogging a lot about stuff. So I usually keep up with what's going on Swift through, you know, Twitter and blogs. And a great blog, if anybody who cares about Swift is not following it, is Erica Sadoun's blog, because she has just like latched onto Swift, like really, really smart thinking, and, you know, giving enhancement requests to the Swift team, and then also sort of summarizing things as they come out. And so I subscribe to her blog at ericasadoun.com, and this is where I learned about the news that I think sort of then started percolating. It started on the mailing list for Swift Evolution. She blogged it, and it's basically sort of like, depending on how you look at it, sad news or glorious news from Chris Lattner. That Swift 3, which was anticipated to have a stable ABI, application binary interface, I believe is what that stands for.
Sounds right.
And it's basically like the contract between how calls are, you know, how compiled code links to, you know, callers to receivers and stuff like that. So in a nutshell, if you have a stable ABI, you can do things like make static libraries or frameworks or whatever, ship them out into the world, and then people can take them and use them in the future. And you know, also, of course, if you don't have a static ABI, then the stuff that you're building and enjoying in Swift today may need to change in the future to continue recompiling with Swift and working the way you expect it. So it's kind of like a big landmark thing that people anticipate for Swift and hope to see, and many hope to see it, especially after they promised it for Swift 3.0. But then Chris Lattner says, basically, you know, it's not going to happen this time around. And they just want to like focus on making the stuff that is already in Swift 3 as good as they can. And so he says, the generics and ABI stability goals will roll into a future release of Swift. But then he also says where he expects them to be the highest priority features to get done. So that's kind of an uncertain mix of messages, I guess. Like, a future release could mean Swift 7.
Right.
But I think it's a reasonable interpretation to assume that this means maybe Swift 4. I don't know, but
yeah, if it's the highest priority, I guess that's the side effect to doing everything in public, right? You're gonna make some guesses at what you're shooting for, and it's not always gonna work out. I personally think this is fine. I'm not really that worried about it. I don't know what the generics features are. Do you? I mean, I know generics, but like, I don't know what new stuff they're working on.
Yeah, I'm not particularly tuned into that.
Okay.
Here's the psychological impact this had on me. You know, I've been like kind of like drinking the Swift Kool-Aid lately, yeah. Right? So, the psychological impact this had on me was to induce some fear, uncertainty, and doubt as to whether I had chosen the right time in history.
Really?
To start using Swift. And I think that fear and doubt is unfounded. But it's just kind of interesting to reflect on it, because I think I had sort of like gauged, I think sort of partly what motivated me to finally go in, diving into Swift with like some gusto was this sense that we're sort of coming to this stability point.
Right.
And the sense that like there was a little bit of maybe smugness, like, haha, I didn't spend all that time in Swift 1 having to rewrite my code all the time. Now, I guess, you know, I knew I would have to rewrite code at this stage because, you know, the ABI is not stable. But I guess I sort of thought, oh, well, I'm only going to have to do like one mm-hmm. real revision, and now that's not true. I'm not particularly worried about that. I tend to think that it's not a big deal to, you know, a lot of the things that they change seem to be stuff that, and knock on wood, I mean, it seems to be stuff that can like kind of be rewritten automatically almost. But there are some philosophical changes coming, especially with like the you know, the stuff we talked about with foundation classes being, you know, getting like value type semantics. So there's some changes that are going to be serious. And I guess then down the road, you know, even more changes now to look forward to. So I guess the concern I have is, did I bite into more of a beta product than I thought
I
was biting into?
As I'm listening to you talk, I'm, like I said 2 minutes ago, it's fine. I'm worried. Yeah. But now I am worried because...
Sorry.
But you're right, though. Like, this is not as mature as it should be in terms of using it for production and everyday apps. I mean, I since I'm working on Swift now, 2.2 or whatever... And I've never gone through one of those transitions because I didn't do 1.0 and everything else. I'm realizing now that I don't know what the pain is going to be like going to 3. And just the fact that there will be another transition to 4 that might break things. Yeah, I'm a little worried maybe for the first time because I was kind of rolling with Swift and like I have some complaints and I spent a lot of time thinking and talking with people lately and reading blog posts like Brent Simmons's post about dynamic functionality in a language. So, I mean, I have things I could complain about and I want for the future, but overall I've been happy. I mean, like Swift is pretty neat. I like, there's some stuff I like about it a lot.
Yeah.
But I guess it just doesn't take much now that I'm listening to you talk, it doesn't take much for me to like start doubting whether, maybe it's too soon. I'm looking at Erica Sadoun's blog. I don't subscribe to it for some reason. I should, but I read posts when I see linked and she always has good stuff. But I'm reading through some stuff now that just highlights to me again the rift between Swift programmers and Objective-C programmers that you kind of predicted even on an earlier show. And it's just a very different mindset in some cases. Like I didn't know that this final by default was still a thing people were asking for, which, I mean, I'd be against a lot of that, those kind of changes that really take the language in a direction that just doesn't feel familiar.
Yeah. I mean, it's this weird time where, I don't know if we talked about it exactly on the show, but an impression I've had recently is that it's kind of interesting that Swift kind of starts at the opposite end of the spectrum from Objective-C and then tries to work its way back. And I can see that having some really good outcomes, like, you know, some of the static stuff you want. Like if you are just working with, you know, value type struct objects, then sure, why not? Like I'd like to have that in Objective-C, but it's interesting to... try to gauge like where the mindset of the Swift team is, where the mindset of Apple as a whole is when you're looking at this language that is not currently well suited to Apple's preeminent frameworks.
Right. Yeah.
It's like, I hate to say it, folks. That is the truth.
Yeah.
And it's like, I'm saying that with love for the Swift team. And I have, you know, gotten the opportunity to chat with some folks from that team. They seem really smart, really thoughtful about Apple's frameworks. They have a limited amount of time and a limited, you know, they've had making any new language is like a monumental feat, but then having to like make a language that also accommodates all the nuances of a framework that was built with a completely different priorities language in mind.
Yeah.
That's like a real challenge, and like I don't envy them that challenge. But the part that makes everything so uncertain to those of us who aren't inside Apple is, you know, how is this eventually going to achieve? And this is something Brent has been doing a great job of lately. Brent Simmons on his blog inessential.com has been just kind of highlighting things that Objective-C does well. And you know, it's funny if. We're also excited about Swift and we're like, this is amazing. I can put like nested functions and I can, you know, value types. I can have like structs with methods and I can do, you know, protocol based programming and all this other great stuff. And then just stop and like unwind it a little bit. You think like this is similar to my reaction, Manton, when the iPad came out. And I was like, well, what if the iPad had been what we had all this time? And then suddenly someone was like, here's an iPad, but it has an external keyboard and, you know, really, like, essentially, like, What if the MacBook had come after the iPad? Right. Everyone would be like, "Oh my God, it's amazing! It's just like an iPad. It's even better." Yeah,
you don't have to like, touch the screen.
There's an aspect to which you could say, if we had been using Swift all these years, and somebody came out with Objective C, there'd be some things that'd be like, "Well, this sucks. There's no type safety." But they'd be like, "Yeah, but
you can message nil."
It's
awesome.
Completely dynamic. Yeah. Yeah, right.
No, I think there's something to that for sure. And that's one of the weird things about Swift is it's trying to be a higher level language and a lower level language at the same time. And so it's like, it's very strange. Like Objective-C, I feel like, I mean, it's obviously a more dynamic language, but in some ways it's almost a higher level language because of the ways you program when you're thinking about a dynamic language like that. But in, 80% of the other ways or whatever, Swift wins. But there is this conflict, and I think you kind of summed it up well in terms of Apple has a great team trying to build a new language. They're trying to build a better language. They are super knowledgeable about this, and they've learned from a lot of different languages. And I think they'll succeed ultimately with that. But then you have developers who don't really care about new languages. We just want to build apps that are great. We want to build apps that are better.
Yeah.
Hopefully we get there at some point. But you ask a lot of developers, like, do you want a new language or do you want a way to build apps 10 times faster or something like that? You know, apps, frameworks, like that, that's the thing that gets a lot of developers excited.
Yeah, and it's funny just to like come full circle sort of here because, we're old timers, so we predate Objective-C on the Mac.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when I first started working in the OS X group at Apple, and I was coming from a Carbon background working on OS 9, and I think I ended up like on the train, taking the train home or something one day with an old school app kit engineer. It was just like, tell me about message sending. Like, what is message sending? Why is it important? Boy, I wish I could remember some of the things that he had to say because, but at the time it was just so foreign to me. I was like, and why would you want to do that? Right. You know? And I feel like that's kind of the same disconnect. Now we have the other direction where it's like, we have some people new to the platform who are like, well, why would I want to do that when I could have everything statically linked and know exactly what's going to happen at compile time? And that was what I was used to, more or less, with C-based, C/Pascal, /assembly, slash whatever you could think of based toolbox. But hey, I guess we drank that Objective-C Kool-Aid pretty well because now we're kind of stuck on it.
Yeah, I love it now. I mean, at the time, I was doing basically all C++, and I spent a lot of years writing C++ code, and I really don't like C++ at all.
Yeah.
But the thing that made it livable is frameworks like PowerPlant from MetroWorks. Like, you could build apps, great apps with a lot of complex UI with a framework like that, like PowerPlant, and there's other frameworks and stuff, but that was the key one at that time. And so it made like dealing with a language that I didn't really like. I don't know if I really even thought about it because like that was just the language. Like everybody used C++. Yeah. Before that, everyone used Pascal. That's just how the transition went for Mac development. I remember being skeptical about Objective-C, but also really excited. And it took me a little while to like fully jump in. It was kind of a similar transition. I mean, there's so many differences, especially around frameworks, but it was similar in some ways in that it's like, there's so many great things about it, but then there's like some gotchas, and we would obsess about stuff that doesn't seem important now, like file types and creator codes and all this legacy in the old Mac OS that we loved. That was kind of under attack when Cocoa was kind of starting to take things over. And so like, you almost can't separate all of those things from that time. It was really interesting, but I think there are some parallels here with Swift.
Well, it's funny because the Objective-C change was kind of like, it came like a hammer. Like it was like, yeah, you will be using Objective-C now. I mean, I don't know, maybe it was more comparable to the Swift versus... Well, it wasn't comparable because you couldn't really opt into using Cocoa without also using Objective-C.
Right. And also, even after Cocoa, even after Next was acquired, Apple released a whole new C-based framework, HI Toolbox.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was Carbon and all that stuff was kind of rolled together. But, like, the Carbon team was doing some really great work. And I think it was very important, especially for legacy apps like Photoshop and those kind of apps to make the transition. But I remember working on an app at that time that was Carbon from day one, mm-hmm. worked on both iOS 9 and iOS 10. iOS 9, geez. It worked on both macOS 9 and macOS 10. And then over time, like, you know, a couple years later, when macOS 10 and Cocoa were more mature, start plugging in more Cocoa and start transitioning to AppKit, because you could kind of mix and match,
yeah,
which was really
that.
Neat.
I had a project like that too. It was a power plant project where I was like pleading in 2002 or 2003. You folks really need to get with Cocoa. Like, and you had to do it like on a per window basis, right? Remember that? Like you could switch to Cocoa,
yeah,
on a per window,
yeah,
basis.
Exactly.
And it was like a big deal. Like, okay, am I ready to take, because if you had a really complicated window, you'd be like, well, it'd be nice if I could just take this one little like sub panel, sub tab.
Yeah.
But you couldn't really do that. You needed to go like all in S window.
Right. I think they might have allowed a way to just do like certain controls. But yeah, I definitely, yeah, at the beginning, it was like that. You could have one window this, one window that, and then you have to deal with, well, wait a minute, the menu bar. How do you dispatch commands? And like, has two right. completely different models. Yeah, good times.
Well, I guess suffice to say, Manton, as spooked as we may be by Swift, possibly having some growing pains over the next few years, we've been around the block. We've gone from 68,000 microprocessor to PowerPC, from OS 9 to OS 10, then from PowerPC to Intel. What else am I missing?
Yeah, there's stuff.
That's that. And though all of those transitions have had pain, and there's all of those transitions have had a lot of skepticism.
Yep.
And, you know, there were people who were like screaming bloody murder that we were going to switch to Intel. And, well, I guess we've got on the horizon now switching to ARM for the Mac.
That will go more smoothly. People are used to the idea now.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I mean, and getting back to the, like, yes, those transitions were bumpy in some ways, but the most important transition, I think, to Cocoa, I mean, you could argue stuff about the hardware and everything, but, like, the Cocoa transition was very, very important. I still don't feel like we're quite the same here with Swift, because there is no new framework. Like, if Apple came out with a new framework for building, yeah, iOS and Mac apps at WWDC that was Swift ready to go, like, that might change things. But I still feel it's not quite the same as back then, because it really was Cocoa. I mean, we were skeptical. We kind of dipped our toes in and maybe moved slowly one window at a time. But
yeah,
you can't argue that Cocoa isn't a faster way to build apps. It is.
Right. I have a sudden prediction to make, which is that we will not see an Apple framework that's Swift only until this ABI is stabilized.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like,
yeah,
they have to be as pragmatic as the rest of us. And like, I was thinking about this earlier when we were talking about, like, so this news doesn't really bum us. I mean, it gave me a little bit of like a fear or whatever, but the people who it really affects are the people who have a real like libraries oriented view of the world. Like, they provide a library to people, you know, like people who are like involved in GitHub and like provide libraries to people. They're sort of like stuck not being able to give libraries to people in Swift that they can just like drop in.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, it's got to be all source for the next year or two. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, it's a dependency that if you start using some Swift-based library and they decide not to update to the latest ABI, then you're going to be stuck doing that yourself. So it's like, it's just not a good environment for that kind of thing. And I don't think Apple wants to ship a framework that they say suddenly, sorry, if your app's not compiled, it's just going to crash when you launch it.
Yeah, you know, this makes me wonder about, because there was some news with the Dropbox SDK and their 2.0 version
Right.
They famously said it's all Swift.
And right.
Some people were probably like, "Ah, great, Swift." And a lot of people were like, "Well, no, we don't want that." And I know one developer, we can find the link and link it up. One developer felt strongly enough that he wrote his own wrappers for the Dropbox API with Objective-C so that you can use his framework in both Objective-C apps and Swift apps. And now I'm wondering, like, first of all, what was Dropbox thinking? And second of all, why aren't they stuck like this? Like, aren't they going to have to rev the framework every time? Assuming they're not shipping Swift source, like, they're going to run into this big problem where every time Xcode changes and the OS changes, they're going to have to, they're going to have to ship multiple versions of their framework.
Because someone
might still be on an old version. They're going to need to match the Swift version. They're going to have like Swift 2.2 framework, Swift 3.0 framework, right? Isn't that how it's going to have to work to be compatible?
If they want to support the older Swift tools, then that is the case. So the saving grace of all this is that anybody who builds with Swift right now, because you bundle all those Swift runtime libraries with your app, you do get locked into the Swift features that you built against. And so any library that you can get your hands on, you can link with whatever version of Swift that you were already linking with. But you're right. It's going to be like, and as this goes on, however many more like significant releases there are that don't have a stable ABI, it's going to be that many versions of the libraries that sort of like the most concerned library providers will feel compelled to provide.
Yeah.
I imagine somebody like Dropbox might just say, sorry, folks, if you want, you know, the latest version of the library, you need to switch to Swift 3 or, you know, but.
And it might not be a huge issue because people already using Swift are probably going to be upgrading pretty quickly about everything. They're probably the type of people that are always on the latest version of Xcode. They're always trying to stay up to date. So it may not be an issue, but it all does kind of circle back to your fear that maybe we're just still a little bit too soon.
Yeah. Well, I think that maybe I should swing my focus a little bit more back around to shipping software than accommodating new languages, but I did have some fun and I'm going to keep using Swift where I can. I think I'm still going to try to stick to my plan of mostly using Swift for new source files, but it did give me a little pause to hear this news. So,
all right. Well, thanks everyone for listening to the show this week. Don't forget the jobs board. We had some jobs posted this week. That's at jobs.corrent.org. If you're looking for a new job, iOS, Mac, Cocoa development, check it out. Of course, if you'd like to hire someone, please post a job there. Mm-hmm. Reaches a nice audience of our listeners who are passionate about iOS development or interested in kind of keeping an eye on what's going on there.
Yeah, there's a pretty good mix. There's even a 100% remote job up there right now. I know that's something that people ask about sometimes, wishing that there was more stuff like that. And a good mix of geographically, at least within the U.S. Could use some more international stuff. So please consider that. If you've got a job anywhere in the world, we would like to connect you with your next Mac or iOS developer. And of course, you can get in touch with us on our Slack team, chat.corrent.org. Lots of great conversations there about all of the stuff we talk about here on the podcast and a lot more, including, much to Manton's chagrin, a pizza channel. So we got it all.
Don't tell me about that. I don't know that exists. All right. Good talking to you. We are a few weeks away from WWDC.
Yep. We'll have more to say in the coming weeks. And then, of course, we hope to see many of you there. And we'll see what news the next week brings and catch up with you again next week.
All right. Bye.